You are listening to Secret Handshake, the podcast covering the movies that help you identify your friends and maybe make a few more along the way. Coming up, Spy number 68, John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, and the enduring influence of the Quatermass experiment. Featuring rocket ships, cosmic rays, space vampires, space bugs, space slime, cranky professors, grumpy government officials, face ripping, satanic slime, murderous homeless folks, and creepy Alice Cooper. Martin.
Yes.
You will not be saved by the Holy Ghost. You will not be saved by the god Plutonium. In fact, you will not be saved. Welcome back to another edition of Secret Handshake. I'm your host, Jacob Knight, and joining me as always is Martin Carlson. Martin, this episode is taking quite a few shapes as we've watched these movies. So I guess what we are covering today is John Carpenter's Prince of Darkness, his 1987, correct? I think fair to say underappreciated masterwork that kind of comes later in his filmography and kind of towards, I don't want to say the twilight of his career, but it's definitely the twilight of his like most iconic run of making genre movies that starts with, you know, Halloween in 1978.
Yeah, because you're also coming right after Big Trouble in Little China, which was a huge budget, like these special effects, like kind of Indiana Jones level of like adventure and Ghostbusters like special effects. And this is a significantly smaller budget. And this is kind of going back to his...
Back to basics, making like Assault. A siege movie.
Yeah, like Assault. Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's him almost making like Quantum Physics Rio Bravo.
Yes. Yeah.
But the other thing that we... I guess the impetus for this episode was you... What was this now? 4 years ago, I want to say?
Yeah.
At the very first Exhumed...
3 years ago, we went.
Was it 3 years ago? Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah, it would be 2021, because 2020, we'd be smack dab in the middle of the pandemic. And this was the return of the Exhumed Films 24-Hour Horror Marathon that you and I flew out and saw in Phoenixville. And in the middle of it, and we watched it with our buddy Simon Abrams there, and in the middle, they played Quatermass in the Pit from 1968, correct?
Or seven, something like that, yeah.
Which is a late era horror movie, Hammer horror movie.
Yeah.
And is kind of like a revival of a character that was invented by Nigel Neal during, well, first during a BBC radio broadcast. Essentially, they were radio plays, and then it became a BBC miniseries.
Yeah, a few miniseries.
And then they were Hammer horror movies. Directed by Val Guest. There's a pair of them from, I want to say,
1954,
and then another's like 56.
Yeah.
And they're directed by Val Guest, who also directed from one of our last episodes, The Abominable Snowman of the Himalayas, which Neil also wrote.
Yeah, they were kind of a partnership, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And Val Guest was one of kind of Hammer's in-house directors. Like, he knocked out a bunch of stuff for them. And, you know, they are in the earliest black and white days of Hammer, right before they kind of go to color, you know, the Bernard Quatermass, which is our main character. It is a very, it's weird. It's this hybrid of science and almost like Lovecraftian, unknowable cosmic evil that is the foundation for these stories that Neil comes up with, that then, you know, Hammer adapts into this sort of sequel, sort of reboot in the late 60s, which is kind of during their twilight years. After all, you know, their great Dracula and Frankenstein movies and all the stuff that they've done with Cushing and Christopher Lee and everything, and made their kind of mark on British, not just British horror, but horror in general. Yeah. And you can tell the revival of the Quatermass character almost feels like, and this is going to be a comparison that I want to shoot myself for, let alone let somebody else shoot me for. It kind of feels like the era of Marvel that we're in now, to where, you know, we've gone through,
remember,
the Incredible Hulk and Captain America and Iron Man and all of these recognizable characters. It's almost them looking at the treasure trove of like IP, which is a dirty word, I know, but that was available to them. It was like, hey, remember when we made these like Quatermass movies and they were really fucking weird in like the 50s? What if we brought that character back? And it turned out, A, that movie's fucking awesome, and I'd never seen it before, Quatermass in the Pit. And B, you and Simon, in particular, we got out of the theater because I believe we saw that movie, and the next movie that was playing was something we weren't particularly interested in.
Yeah, we went for a walk.
So we decided to go catch some food or whatever,
yep,
and some air, and you and Simon just totally geeked out about Nigel Neal.
Well, I want to thank my friend Jason Murphy. He's a local screener. Now, he's in Texas. He moved. But we were talking one day at lunch. And this is before I saw anything Quatermass, five, 6 years ago. And he goes, you know, I think you'd like... It's like, Nigel Neal. I'm like, who the fuck is that? And he did the whole thing. He's like, well, it was like, he kind of was like a guy that's not talked about a lot. But like, anything, like X-Files owes so much to him.
Right.
This, like, you watch certain episodes, like, literally as an episode... Space season one of X-Files, which is the first movie of Quatermass. It's the same story of, you know, guy goes to space, brings something back, you know, and the mixture of science fiction and the mixture of horror and Lovecraftian, something, an unknowable evil beyond the stars. But then he was like, he's like, did you ever notice how Prince of Darkness, like the screenwriter's last name was Quatermass? That's just John Carpenter as a tribute to Nigel Neal. He loves. Oh, did you also know that Nigel Neal was one of the guys who wrote the original screenplay for Halloween 3? And it was just this like rabbit hole of, here's this guy who not a lot of people talk about, who is just like, his roots go throughout horror and sci-fi. It's really pretty crazy. Once you learn about it, you're like, it's this like kind of like, deep state of Nigel Neal. Like, it's all connected.
Well, it's like one of the epitomes of like an unsung hero.
He's the definition of that.
To where like he was the guy who was churning out stories for Hammer Horror.
Yes.
He wrote stuff even in the 70s that we really like The Stone Tape, which is a fantastic movie. But then the story before, I guess, we get into Prince of Darkness is that, you know, Halloween 3 comes along, which was... So when we pitched this episode and we were coming up with the idea for it and the titles that we were putting together, is we're like, okay, obviously the Quatermass experiment, Quatermass 2.
Quatermass in the Pit.
Quatermass in the Pit. Prince of Darkness. Toby Hooper's Life Force, which, whew.
Straight up Quatermass movie.
Yeah, and might be, even though we made, because originally we were going to make Life Force kind of the focus of this episode, because one of the most ridiculous parts about Life Force is that Toby Hooper, a guy from Austin, Texas, who's, you know, most known for making the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, signs this deal with Canon Films, mainly to make Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2 with them. But then he makes this kind of string of very, very strange big budget movies during like the heyday of Golan and Globus.
When they're spending the most.
And they're spending the most money. And let me tell you, all the money is on screen when it comes to Life Force. But one of the most ridiculous things about it is this guy from Texas who teams up with these Israeli cousin film producers who are kind of at the peak of their powers and are allowing anybody to come in and kind of exact like their wildest fantasies as long as it fits into their kind of B-movie story frame. Toby Hooper goes and makes a movie that feels authentically British and authentically in the vein of those Hammer horror movies.
Well, because he's, I mean, how many times have we had people have the discussion about, you know, did Toby Hooper do Poltergeist? And I think the real question is, how versatile is Toby Hooper?
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that's more the conversation. I think that, obviously, it's a different combo, but you have Spielberg as producer. It's going to look like an Amblin movie. That's sure. You know, inevitable. But
you can't escape the producer's touch just in the same way that you can, like, he can't escape the producer's touch in making Life Force for Canon Films, because this is still like, it's like the trashiest version of a Hammer horror movie, or like a Hammer update on, if like Quatermass in the Pit is an update on the original 50s Quatermass movies, Life Force is like the 80s trash, like 42nd Street version of a 60s Quatermass in the Pit, only it has Matilda May being naked the whole time. It has Steve Railsback having like cosmic orgies with her where they're both naked and shooting laser beams into each other's eyes. There's insane gore moments.
Yeah.
And then it ends with an apocalyptic, essentially like 28 days later precursor zombie film where like half of downtown London is possessed by, I guess, cosmic ray space vampires and become like zombies who are trying to suck the literal life force out of other human beings. Like, it's bonkers to the level that Toby Hooper takes it, but you can tell that he had the movie that he wanted to make, is that he was kind of like Carpenter and making Prince of Darkness and was like, I want to make my Quatermass movie. And Golan and Globus are like, that's great. We need boobs and gore. And also, here's all the cocaine money that we fucking got at our disposal, and you're going to shoot it in fucking England. And Toby Hooper's like, did you say cocaine?
Well, it's such a maximalist movie. You
exactly.
Know?
And especially in the last 30 minutes.
You can really feel the Golan Globus touch. You know,
right.
There's something about, you know, it's really funny about all the Quatermass movies, though, is they're really... there are these mysteries that start where you're it's just completely a walking in with like almost like a locker room mystery of like the whole mystery of like there's water on the floor and someone is hanging. It's like, oh, there's an ice cube. It's like that kind of like,
yeah.
You have no idea how this could have happened. And you slowly, they're all mysteries, and you slowly go deeper and deeper into the world and the mythology of these monsters or of the politics of what's happening. And there's all of that in Life Force, but plus, like you're saying, the schlock factor. And there's schlock in the other ones as well, but they all do have a pretty ridiculous... They all... one thing Neil, I think, understood is, like, you got to end with a bang. Because, like, all three of those have pretty big... For what the budget they had. Like, the end of The Pit is very similar to the end of Life Force. I mean, even the way it looks. Like, that look of England and under siege and the kind of the... the giant space bug kind of taking form over Hobbs, and, you know, it's really apocalyptic.
Yeah, well, let's lay out for those who have never seen any of the Quatermass movies kind of what they looked like. Is that, you know, in the original Quatermass experiment, you have a very stuffy physicist, correct?
I think he's literally a rocket scientist, yeah.
Who is in the middle of conducting these rocket science experiments, shooting one up into outer space. It crashes on an old kind of countryside farm, and they go in to try and extract the, I guess we call them astronauts, from it, and find out that, you know, at least two of them have been deflated
gone. They can't fight, and then one guy's alive.
Is basically, but he's also catatonic.
Yeah.
And then we essentially find out that a unknowable force passed through the rocket ship and possessed the guy who's catatonic.
Yep.
And is now able to essentially jump bodies and do whatever it wants. And it's also almost like, again, sort of, you can see the way these Quatermass movies, their influence kind of trickled into these later films we're going to talk about, is that, like, it becomes about this unknowable entity almost collecting flesh and life forces as it moves along until it becomes, quite frankly, like, it, one of the most mind-blowing things about the early 50s one is that, you know, by the end, they're battling one of Lovecraft's old ones. Yeah. Like, it becomes a giant...
Or
like
a kaiju, maybe. Yeah,
or like octopus monster that they are putting on TV through, like, a broadcast because it's, like, their first contact with this inhuman, unknowable entity. And they essentially have to battle it to the death by the end. But, like...
With science!
Yeah, with science. But the majority of this early movies, like Quatermass Experiment and Quatermass 2, are just dudes talking in rooms. Just scientists being pragmatic and being like, how do we deal with this? Like, what do we do? And, like, Hooper, for all of the big canon film spectacle that he puts onto the screen, one of the big downfalls of Life Force is, like, basically, you know, the first act is fucking awesome. Like, I was watching it last night on Plex on the porch, and Shapiro comes out and he, you know, is smoking a cigarette and he looks at the TV and he's like, this looks fucking awesome. Like, just straight up. He's like, every time this movie's on, I can't believe how fucking great it's this so movie cool. looks. And I'm like, I know. Isn't it awesome? And it really is. Like, the intro, the first 30 minutes of fucking Life Force.
It's like Alien.
You're they just, it, it's yeah. straight up. Well, and yeah, it's also it's co-written by yeah, Dan exactly. O'Bannon and, like, one of his writing partners. And it's like, you know, you're in outer space. You're on a co-captained, like, a space charter yeah. between Americans and British astronauts. They find, because they're out there to explore Halley's Comet, and they find in the tail of the comet essentially these space vampires that live in, like, floating crystals
in a giant, cool, fucking gothic looking space needle ship. It's well, so fucking cool.
I wanted to talk about that. Is that a space anus?
Oh, it's a, well, they again, Alien, right? They're like, they're like, we can't afford Giger, but let's get some assholes in here. And
exactly.
You
yeah.
know?
There's some vaginal openings in outer space and everything that Steve Railsback and the team are basically ascending through. And then they find Matilda May, who might be the hottest human being ever committed to screen. Who's naked dumb. For the entire film. Like, it's literally introducing Matilda May is how, you know, her credit reads during the opening credits, and you're like, we never saw her really again, but her image was burned Jackal. Into our brains forever. Bruce Willis movie?
She shows up as in, like, one or two scenes as Richard Gere's old Irish girlfriend from his IRA days.
And shut your whore mouth.
And I remember watching it, and I was like, she looks familiar, and then I was
I've
like...
I've seen those boobs before.
Well, but it's such a... But what I think what you're getting to, though, right, is you get to this, you lose the spark of Neil when, like, Hooper and them try to do the kind of more staid, stuffy British conversation stuff. Because what Neil really had was a sense of humor. And when he was writing stuff, like, you watch, like, especially because he didn't write the screenplay or the story for Quatermass 1. Because the second one, you could tell with Quatermass 2, the dialogue is snappier and funnier. He had a really dark sense of humor. And you get to Stone Tape, and it's downright funny.
Yeah.
Like, the way that people talk, the realism of, like, how the camaraderie of how people work in a business.
Well, I mean, even Halloween 3
yeah.
is, like, I was doing some research, because we were texting back and forth while I was watching that one, too. Because that movie I've seen probably 30 times mm-hmm. at this point. And I'd never really known the backstory of Nigel Neal coming on, basically being hired to make this movie, and more or less disowning it by the end and asking to have his name taken off. But if you do the actual research, because the other thing is Tommy Lee Wallace, you know, who ends up directing the movie, and it really only had, he ends up basically punching up the script.
Yeah. He has sole credit, right?
He more or less has sole credit on the film, even though, like, there are uncredited passes, I believe, by John Carpenter and, you know, Nigel Neal.
Yeah.
His name's not on it, but, like, you can find people, you know, write-ups of people who have read the script and stuff online and everything, and they're basically like, it's kind of the same thing. Like, the changes are very superficial, and Tommy Lee Wallace's only real credit writing-wise before that was, like, Amityville 2, The Possession, I want to say. But he comes on as writer and director. But who originally was supposed to direct a movie was Joe fucking Dante.
Yep.
And, like,
he was a huge Nigel Neal fan, too.
And when you think about it, with Nigel Neal's sense of humor and goofiness and stuff, and, like, him writing, like, it's almost like him taking the piss out of American consumerism the entire time, because it's like, what if some crazed mad scientist was like, I'm going to steal Stonehenge, break little pieces of it off, put it into Halloween masks, and then sell it back to the children. Because apparently the biggest change in Nigel Neal's original script is that, you know, Colonel Coughlin's motivation was just mischief. Like, he was just doing it as a goof, essentially.
Yeah. Oh, almost that leprechaun-y kind of.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. To where, you know, Tommy Lee Wallace changes it to where it's all about the blood sacrifices that used to happen in the old days and the Celtic lands and everything, and how the hills ran red with blood.
Great
and
speech.
It was to bring the sacrifices back. Now, here's the thing. I actually think this motivation's better than what Nigel Neal, you know, originally intended. But the thing is, the fact still remains that all of his architecture and sense of humor are still very much present, because when you write down, as much as we love Halloween 3, and I'm glad that Halloween 3 has been completely reclaimed, if you write down what Halloween 3 is about on fucking paper, you're like, what?
Well, and the other thing too, you know, I kept thinking, I had never seen Quatermass 1 and 2 before until this time.
Right.
And it was so much fun. I watched Quatermass 2, and then Quatermass in the Pit in a row. And it was a great, because they're all like an hour and 20 minutes. It's fucking just, they move really well. But with Halloween 3, you see elements of Halloween 3 and Quatermass 2. It's like the Irish dance, the idea of a secret town.
Yeah.
We're doing this huge experiment. People say, oh, you're crazy. No, everything's fine here. Everyone's super, super happy. Why wouldn't you be happy? You know, and everyone, and it's idea of like, and you have their version of Halloween 3 of these robot men, these robot creatures who are basically the equivalent of these mind-controlled monster people we have in Quatermass 2. You can almost see the seeds he had. And again, you go to this Irish dance. And I think I could just see in my brain his connective tissue. What was there a town that was like all Irish American, and they made Halloween stuff, and they were doing druidic kind of mystical magic stuff? And you can just see it there, you know, and you see the through line to Halloween 3.
Even though the movie predates it, there's like a decent amount of like the Wicker Man.
Yes. You could see folklore all the way. Yeah.
Quatermass 2. But then, you know, Life Force ends up almost being a combination of Quatermass 1 and Quatermass 2 because, you know, Quatermass has the rocket ship launch, the astronaut come back, bringing something back with him, the journey out into the fields of England to find him, which is like one of the most English parts of a movie made by a guy from Austin fucking Texas.
Yeah.
Like when Matilda, you know, the space vampire essentially jumps from Matilda May's body to that stunning redhead.
Oh, what the fuck?
Who's just walking through the spirit, like, the only rolling hills. Yeah. Yeah. And so did Golden Globus, I have a feeling.
I don't think it's the vampire.
Yeah.
It was those two men.
But like, you know, you go out into the countryside to pursue this entity, which in the original Quatermass experiment leads to, you know, Valgest directing a scene that almost feels like a direct reference to Frankenstein.
Oh, where, dude, like, seriously,
the possessed astronaut encounters that little girl, and the whole time the tension is like, is he going to kill this fucking child the whole time? Like, it's the monster meeting pure innocence.
Yo, because he, and it's a cool scene. Cause like they go all the way with it. Like she walks, they follow her down to like the riverside or like to the side of the canal. And she's pushing this little baby cart with a doll in it.
Yeah.
And she puts the doll down and she's like talking to the doll, and we're going to have a tea party. And in the back, there's this old broken down kind of canal ship.
Right.
And it's super, super low. And you hear the sound coming from it. She goes, "Oh, don't worry, Dolly. That's just the rats that live in there." And then the camera is on her behind her. This creature man is just crawling slowly out. And it's genuinely like a pretty unsettling scene. Like you said, it's a ticking time bomb.
Well, and there's two scenes in this. There's three in particular in the original Quatermass experiment that I think are absolutely like mind-bogglingly great. Is that there's that scene. And then there's the scene where right before the astronaut, you know, kind of breaks out of the little hospital room where he's taken, where in the background, you know, I believe it's his fiance.
Yep. She's sitting in the chair.
She's sitting in the chair and he's this catatonic kind of figure. And then all of a sudden in the back, you have a conversation happening in the foreground between Quatermass and I believe the doctor who's tending to him, who's really like a scientist and is basically like, I don't know what the fuck I'm doing. Like, I don't treat human beings. I do, you know, hypothetical research more or less. And in the background, you have him coming aligned and then like slowly starting to attack his like partner. And it's really chilling. And then the other scene that I love that honestly is translated directly, not directly, but they do a riff on in, you know, the 60s Quatermass in the Pit is the, when they retrieve the film
from the
rocket ship and they review it for the moment when the cosmic rays actually pass through the rocket ship, like it becomes almost like an industrial film for a minute. And you become the observer along with the scientists trying to figure out like what actually did fucking happen in this. It's like, it's almost like listening to like a black box from like a downed, you know, aircraft and trying to figure out how did this aircraft go down.
Well, it's like, or a found footage scene in a modern film, you know, of like, here's the tape we found of what happened to the previous crew, or the equivalent of the CD they find in Event Horizon.
Exactly.
What happened to the crew before. And it's,
you've seen that effect, or really any found footage movie
exactly
that we've ever seen is like, that's the idea, is that it's like we found, or one of our other favorites, Leviathan, where they find like the old tapes from the ship that they find. But it's like you see this movie's influence rippling out, and then that's kind of, it's weird that like, you know, in the second half of Life Force, Hooper takes essentially the alien invasion parts of Quatermass 2 and just amps that up on like total fucking steroids the entire time, but kind of loses the thread.
Yeah.
To where in Quatermass in the Pit, you know, the film is really like the psychic messages that are being sent back when we realize what's happening in that one. Because in Quatermass in the Pit, essentially what they do is, you know, a bunch of workers are working on the subway, the underground.
An expansion.
And Hobbs End. And they find what they originally think was a bomb from like World War II.
Like a V2 rocket or something, yeah.
And as they do more digging, they realize that it's also like a bug-shaped rocket ship. And they get inside of it and everything, and they retrieve the corpses of these like bug aliens. And they're trying to figure out like what happened here.
And humanoids that were around it with weird shaped heads.
Exactly. Yeah. And it turns out because they, through a series of events that you really kind of have to witness for yourself, because this movie almost goes from using very pragmatic science to operating on borderline like dream logic.
Yep.
Is that the Martians, they start to call them, start sending down signals of their history that they view psychically. And this is like the movie part of it, in that we find out that the Martians were essentially in a war against themselves and experiencing genocide. And they were essentially coming down to Earth, taking people, doing
taking apes.
Apes. Well, I thought it was people.
It was apes. They brought them up. They're the reason that we're human beings. Like, that's how crazy this movie gets.
Yeah, they essentially evolved us. Oh, that's right. They essentially invent Darwinism.
Yes.
Because they more or less take the apes, impregnate them with their DNA, bring them back, and then that's how evolution on Earth essentially happens, because they wanted to recolonize another planet to escape the Holocaust that was essentially happening on theirs. And then the movie ends with, as you said, like, these are the parts to where, like, Life Force and the Quatermass movies, like, really line up, is the apocalyptic finale of Quatermass in the Pit, to where, again, Toby Hooper just does his version of it, but on, like, total steroids, to where instead of zombies taking over and destroying everything like they do in Life Force, in the end of Quatermass in the Pit, it's a giant spectral bug. Because that was the other thing that I really liked, is that there were almost like these abandoned homes that were above Hobbs End, which, you know, to do another John Carpenter reference, what movie has Hobbs End in it? In the Mouth of Madness.
Yep. Oh, you know? He loves him some Nigel Neal.
Man. But like the houses above, you know, the London Underground station where all this is occurring, and this spaceship is laid dormant for so long, they're seeing what they think are ghosts. And they're really almost like astral projections that the bugs and the aliens are projecting out, trying to get outside of the spaceship. And the end ends with a massive kaiju-sized astral projection of one of these bugs basically wreaking havoc on London as Quatermass and his very good looking sidekick try to defeat it. And it's fucking awesome.
Well, and to your point, when I first saw anything Quatermass officially, and my brain like broke open, because it was like, there's so many. Nigel Neal, you can see, is an idea machine, because this movie.
Yeah, 100%.
This movie's 97 minutes, and it has about. It has about six plots worth of horror and sci-fi world building in one fucking movie.
Yeah.
Because you have this idea, first of all, again, it's this great mystery of, like, there's been a lot of stories since the olden days about Hobbs End. And, you know, people always saw ghosts, and actually no one wanted to live there anymore. It was this lower income neighborhood. Maybe it was just ghosts. Why was it? Oh, it's actually these aliens down there, and they've been, like you said, they've been kind of like psychically connecting to the people above and showing them things and making them be afraid. And you also get part of what's happening in the end is you have this giant astral bug, but what's creating it is the people's minds, because these things awaken in us our dormant psychic abilities.
It's a hive mind.
Which they built in, and we're part of the hive mind. But it depends on your DNA, so there's people on the streets who are now infected by this and part of it, and some that are not. It's like the fucking race war from Mars is now playing out in the streets of London, panic on the streets of London. It is... I cannot recommend this movie to sci-fi and horror people enough. I really can't. I mean, it's so fucking... And it really plays well still. And it's funny, and it's British, and like, it's like
very British.
And the color, though, is just like that saturated late 60s. Like, get the Blu-ray. It's just this beautiful fucking movie. Like, I could watch it all the time.
Yeah, and it has that same color palette and almost like swinging London feel as something like the Satanic Rites of Dracula
100%.
Did. 100%. Where you almost had like... a James Bond ripoff film in the middle of your Dracula. Like, this was when, like, you could tell, like, Hammer Films was at the end of its main run, and they were like, what do we do now? And it resulted in some of the wildest shit they could fucking come up with Quatermass in the Pit. Like, it really is a movie. Seven Golden Vampires,
same director.
Oh, Roy Ward Baker, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like, you watch them and you go... Well, God bless, because you guys just let people basically throw paint at the walls just to see what, you know, the splatter patterns would essentially look like. And they're pretty wild.
Well, and then again, just the connection that it connects it on a extra textual level to Life Force again, right? Of here's this filmmaker being able to go wild with a lot of ideas.
It's, and money.
You know, and money, and not being held in by, well, what's the pitch? Right, because they're like, cool, it's based on a book called Space Vampires. Seems easy enough. Space Vampires.
Well, apparently the pitch, according to the documentary Electric Boogaloo, the wild, untold story of Canon Films that Mark Hartley directed, right?
So fucking good.
And it's like his follow-up to Not Quite Hollywood, the Ozploitation documentary. Golan and Globus gave the book to Tobe Hooper and essentially said, this is going to be one of your movies, because he inked a deal with them that I believe was like a three-picture deal, because it covers Texas Chainsaw 2, Life Force, and then Invaders from Mars.
Yeah.
None of which were the movies that Canon Films really expected or wanted.
Especially with Invaders from Mars, too, I've heard.
Yeah, I mean, like, that was the one that they really were like, what the fuck are you doing here? Which, I mean, I don't blame them, because I'm not a huge Invaders from Mars fan.
It looks really cool.
It's super cool looking, but it's kind of a slog to sit through.
Definition of a slog.
But apparently the pitch was, they were like, you're going to make this space vampires book. And Tobe Hooper just took that and like was like, okay, well, I'm going to make it this way then. But I guess to bring it around to Prince of Darkness, one of the things that I love the most about Prince of Darkness is that it's like a 1-2 pairing of movies that really stand out in Carpenter's filmography, and that you have Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness.
Yeah.
And they're two of, I guess, what are now termed as the Apocalypse trilogy. Yeah,
plus The Thing.
That starts with The Thing. But to me, Prince of Darkness and In the Mouth of Madness feel much more apocalyptic than The Thing ever did.
Yeah.
Although Prince of Darkness feels, it's weird, In the Mouth of Madness, as much as I love that movie, and my yearly rewatch is coming up very soon here since we're in October, that feels almost like an abnormality in Carpenter's filmography, because it's a road movie, it's expansive, it's not, you know, like The Thing, like Escape from Precinct 13, even like Halloween, it's not contained. It's not in one location for the majority of the time, and it doesn't really become a siege picture. Because that's the thing, it's like all those movies I just listed, they're all siege movies in one way or another.
Yeah.
I mean, Assault on Precinct 13 is straight up just Rio Bravo.
Yeah.
But in L.A.
gangland. They're all Howard Hawks, and they're men together learning how to communicate.
Exactly. Yeah. The Thing is a siege picture, only the siege is coming from inside. It's literally figuring out which alien or which of them is the alien. Halloween, in its own way, is a siege picture, because it's about a maniac who comes to suburbia and traps these babysitters in these white picket-fenced suburban homes. And so, like, Prince of Darkness almost feels, in its own weird way, even building off of Big Trouble in Little China, because it's big and adventurous and kind of a throwback to the old serials and Shaw Brothers kung fu movies and stuff that he was doing with Big Trouble. That's also a pretty contained movie.
It is,
The containment is in this expansive underworld that these kind of mystical beings have created. But Prince of Darkness feels like him really getting back to basics and being like, okay, here's a bunch of scientists. We put them in this old church. They're doing this research on this unknowable evil. And then all of a sudden they're besieged kind of from within and outside, because, like, to take it back to your idea about the Quatermass movies, is that, like, the homeless folks who start to become possessed by the evil force that's in this container that they find in this old church, it are the threats from outside of the church. And then once the evil liquid that breaks free from this container and starts possessing people, then it's almost like, it's weird, it's almost like Assault on Precinct 13 and The Thing happening all at once, only we're never guessing who's actually possessed. Like, we know these people all just become like psycho demon zombies that start tearing people apart.
Yeah, and he has less interest in the rules behind it in Prince of Darkness too, right? Because I think with The Thing, you get into the science really, but like strong science of, like, you have Blair saying it's an organism, you know, it's trying to replicate, and it's like very, very clear the life cycle of this thing. Now it's crazy.
Right down to the blood test scene that's very now famous.
And it's and you go bit by bit of like, well, we're all scientists, let's science the shit out of this, right? And we're gonna solve it. We're all gonna eat out of cans, all these things are gonna do. This one, one of the things really like I used to not like about this movie, and now I like, is I don't think that Carpenter cares that like this is, you know, authentic making sense quantum physics. Like the discussions they have in class before they go there are complete gobbledygook. They're complete, like, I love Victor Wong, but a lot of things he's, I mean, I guess part of it, he's like, you get to the subatomic level and everything falls apart, which is quantum, you know, quantum mechanics and quantum physics, right? And which I think is cool. And I like the idea, the simple idea of what if at the subatomic level, that's what the devil is, right? Is like, there's this idea that within science,
for all matter, there's antimatter.
There's antimatter. And I like that. That's where I think the Nigel Neal influence really comes in, is this blurring between science and magic, right? And the idea that they can both be describing the same thing. And you have also the relationship between Donald Pleasence and Victor Wong in this movie is very similar to, they're already friends at this point. They've obviously been on adventures together before, right?
Sure.
I like to think this is like their fifth adventure. You know, they've fought something before. But you also have, it's very similar to other Quatermass films, is Quatermass usually has a cop. It's, I'm sorry, I forget the name, Lomax. His kind of, his cop alternate or opposite, who they're usually arguing about, like, hey, this is not how it's done. I need you know, official procedure to be followed.
Yeah, it's literally law versus, like, almost the scientific method.
Yeah, and or just saying, like, I don't care what you have to do. Like, this is going to happen. It's like also like a kaiju movie, right? It's like,
right,
officials, you have to listen to me. Like, or a disaster movie. Like, there's going to be a huge earthquake if we don't, you know, or we got to go to the core of the earth or whatever. But I think that's what I really like about this one, is you get that mixture of, you have a clergyman, you have all these different types of scientists coming in. But once they start talking, it's all bullshit.
It's kind of gobbledygook.
It's so funny, but I usually kind of zone out, but I like it.
But it's also, it's why it pairs so well with In the Mouth of Madness, is that it's also the idea of deconstructing belief structures.
Yes.
To where, you know, In the Mouth of Madness is literally about, you know, what essentially would happen if, like, a hack horror writer, like a even sub Stephen King kind of stand-in, like a Dean Koontz. Yeah. What if he became God? What if his readership became so great that things, like, reality shifted because people believed in it? And essentially, Prince of Darkness asks a lot of the same questions. Is that, that's one of the things that I love about the movie and latched onto most this time, is that that very early idea of, like, okay, we've all been told for years and years and years, for as long as people and religion have existed, that evil is an unknowable force. You can't reach out and grab it. You can't see it. You can't touch it. You can't taste it. But what if that was bullshit?
Yeah.
What if evil actually was matter? And what if you could contain it? What if it is in this giant canister and is this swirling green, like, goop, essentially? And I like the idea that they essentially say, like, especially Donald Pleasence's clergyman says, like, hey, man, the Brotherhood of Sleep, which is this, like, secret order of, like, priests who are meant to keep this secret throughout time, they've just been lying to you the whole time. Like, we, you know, the church, everybody, evil is real, and it's right over there. Like, it's in that jar. You know, it's not in that guy. It's not Hitler. It's not, you know, that, like, humans are still capable of evil.
Yeah, they're infected by it.
But also, you can see, like, you can touch and you can taste evil itself. And I love that idea, to where it's like, you know, a power can be manifested to a degree that it actually takes physical shape.
Well, again, that's super, again, super Quatermass. You get that with especially the pit, you know, the idea of two things you're saying. You have the manifestation of thought, you know, or of a what is thought to be a non-physical object or being can take on physical form, right? but you also have the idea of someone like Quatermass or someone like Victor Wong's character saying, like, everything you've been told is wrong.
Right.
You know, everything, all your belief structures, everything you believe in your science books and everything, this is going to blow all of that out of the water. And so, of course, people, the one thing I would say that you don't get as much of in Prince of Darkness, which I'm fine, is not a lot of pushback. You know, because in the Quatermass films, a lot of it is this combative thing happening between him and between like other authority figures about that can't be real. You know, especially like Julian Glover, who's amazing in Quatermass in the Pit, by the way, young Julian Glover, constantly being like, well, I just think this is a psyop. You know, yeah. I think this was buried by the Germans to be found by us. And this is having the, and we're going to, they're going to put these alien carcasses in there. It's honestly, this, watching these movies, my brain was really blowing up in a lot of ways. Number one, a lot of the mythology that Maggie Neal puts forward is like L. Ron Hubbard mythology. Like, the description of what we're talking about for Quatermass in the Pit sounds like Scientology to me.
Oh, 100%. I had that thought, too.
And then also that fucking, is Quatermass the original Elon Musk? He's this privatized rocket guy who sees him, who's always fighting with authority. Now, Quatermass fucking rules. Elon Musk fucking sucks. But, like, that idea of how they see themselves. Because Quatermass, the one thing we got to talk about, he's a dick. Especially in the first two movies, Don Levy is an asshole to everybody.
Yeah, he's a real prickly character.
He just comes in and yells all the fucking time. Like, he just, like, why? He's just yelling at all his workers all the fucking time. The guy who, I forget his name, who plays him in the Pit, is much more charming and professorly. Like, he kind of looks like Sean Connery in Last Crusade.
He reminded me a lot of Michael Gambon.
Oh, that's a good one. He's very warm.
Yeah.
In his way.
But the other thing about Prince of Darkness, I guess to get into kind of what we were talking about off mic before we even started recording, is that, like, in tackling a movie about all of these ideas, Carpenter essentially makes something that's borderline formless and, mm-hmm. and yeah. plotless.
Yes.
And that, like, it moves almost in the way that you would expect antimatter to move.
Yeah.
In that it's like you drift with it and it creates,
you vibe with it.
Exactly. Yeah. And that was the thing, is I hate using these terms because they're just so played out now in modern criticism, but it is 100% a vibe movie, especially from a guy, as we just kind of laid out, is so Hawksian.
Yeah.
And is so into, like, very simple
plot
structures. Like, what if this gang trapped this cop and this gang member in a station and they had to bond together and fight their way out? What if this alien infected this group of researchers and they had to figure out which one of them was an alien? What if this masked guy invaded suburbia and started killing babysitters? This is like, what if we discovered that the entirety of what we know about both science and religion was completely incorrect? And what if this group of very old-looking grad students were tasked...
They look older than us, dude.
By their professor. I'm fucking
41.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to get into that in a second. Because the guy who's essentially the Tom Atkins stand-in, I'm like... This motherfucker, like, 52. Like, what are you still doing in grad school, brother? But, like, what if these guys were tasked essentially by their professor to go to an old church in the middle of L.A. and investigate the very nature of the anti-God particle? Sure. What do you do from there, man?
Well, it feels very much of a piece with his follow-up film, They Live. And while They Live has much more plot, the feeling of both these movies and the time period and the budget is so similar. And there is a somewhat, there's moments of They Live that feel kind of formless, specifically when they're hanging out within the encampment.
Well, is that part of, I guess this was another thought that I had while watching Prince of Darkness. And this is, so this movie I've gone back and forth on for as long as I've seen it, and that's for now over 20 years.
Yeah,
was the first time I probably saw this.
Yeah, I was in high school for sure.
And, like, every time I watch it, my opinion of it changes. The first time I watched it, I was like, well, that's like bottom five Carpenter. Like, I don't like that at all. And then I would watch it again on VHS and be like, maybe that's actually pretty good. There's shit in there that I really like. I like the face ripping at the end, the mirror stuff, all that crazy, like basically From Beyond style.
Yeah.
Almost like Euro horror that populates the end.
Kind of Fulci-ish at moments too.
And then I saw it on 35mm and I really liked it in the theater because you realize that it's maybe one of Carpenter's stealthily most like visually dynamic movies. Mm. It looks incredible the entire time. And now on this last rewatch, I was like, is this a masterpiece? Is this actually one of Carpenter's like secret masterpieces? Because like I just sank into it. And I also had the thought kind of in keeping with your linking it to They Live is like, is this movie born from Carpenter's tried and true anti-authoritarian streak to where he's always questioning? Because essentially what Prince of Darkness and They Live and In the Mouth of Madness to a lesser degree, although I guess to a greater degree by the end when the whole fucking world ends. But like, is it about questioning not only your reality, but also all of those who have sold you a reality for the entirety of your life and what that reality is essentially built upon?
I love that read because while I'm not quite on the masterpiece thing yet. I will say my opinion always changes on this movie. It really depends on my mood. We showed it to my friend Daniel when he had never seen it. One night we're at your house and he was blown away. He was like, this is the one I haven't seen a Carpenter. And I think it's a film.
And that night I didn't like it.
Yeah.
And I watched it. And I was like, eh, this is kind of a slog.
Honestly, last night watching it, it wasn't my favorite watch. I just think because I also watch these other movies and there's other times where I get on it. I think it's a wavelength thing too, right?
I think like, it really is too. It's a vibe moment.
And if there's certain days where it's like a rainy day and I have like a whiskey or a coffee in my hand and I'm just like, I want to zone in on this fucking movie and like get on its fucking wavelength. It sounds so like nonsensical, but I believe it with this kind of movie. But I think, again, it really links well to Nigel Neal because there is a real kind of, I wouldn't say anarchist, but definitely a kind of anti-authoritarian feel to all of his stuff too, because I was watching this, there's this great book on from the BFI Film Classics Library done Kim Newman, the film historian.
Okay.
And he's just the best with horror. I mean, that guy just is a complete fucking just encyclopedia in his head. And he was talking about like when these things, a lot of these were first aired as before the movies first aired on BBC. This is a time of like economic trouble in England, and they were rolling blackouts, and like they literally kept fucking BBC on late on Christmas to air one of the serials because people were like, they're like, this could play pretty well. But there is a sense of like lack of trust in the government. Like you're going to trust this individual scientist who's pushing back against authority. And like you said, pushing back against like religion, pushing back against all of our like known tenets about like, this is what reality is. And I think that Quatermass in a way too is like is a weird kind of yin and yang with like Doctor Who, you know, these British smarter scientist guys. One obviously is this Time Lord, but they're very mixed. They mix together in a really kind of interesting way.
Well, I also think in Prince of Darkness that the casting of Alice Cooper isn't a coincidence.
100%.
Let's say. And in
he's the face of the movie too. In a lot of the,
exactly,
a lot of the ads. He's barely in it, but he's like the face.
And it's him without makeup. And he has one of the best kills where he impales the one guy with the bike.
Yep.
But it's kind of, you know, linking it with They Live again in casting, you know, Rowdy Roddy Piper.
Yeah.
Is that Carpenter was obviously fascinated by these art forms that were in vogue at the time and very popular in metal music,
yeah,
with Alice Cooper and particularly almost like glam metal.
Yeah.
You know, and then with Rowdy Roddy Piper, the WWF and pro wrestling and everything. Yeah. And
really blowing up at that time.
Exactly. Yeah. But these things that were also just kind of seen as like trashy lower art.
Throwaway. Yeah.
But that could be used as vessels to make like a greater point and to essentially throw that trashiness in your face and interrogate why we think it's trashy in the first place. And that I love the Alice Cooper part of it, because if you think about it, you know, this is in the middle of Satanic Panic.
Yeah.
And like how we're being fed by so many people, you know, with you know, Dee Snider testifying before court and, you know, records being burned and parents and school boards and stuff, you know, trying to get them banned from like schools and everything. And like, you know, being told that like, you know, there are satanic powers inside of this music. Like, it almost feels like Carpenter casting Alice Cooper to be like, he's just a guy.
Yeah. But like, but also fuck you.
But he could be possessed by evil, but that's what real evil actually is. It's not music that you listen to. It's not like, you know, wrestling's not going to make your kids go out there and suddenly want to like flip tables and fight other people. I mean, it probably will, but you know.
Yeah.
But it's like he liked taking these things that other people kind of looked down upon and were like, I actually think this is pretty fucking cool, and I'm going to use them to make a point.
Well, and you get, I mean, not to go too long on They Live, but you get one of my mine and a lot of people's favorite scenes in Carpenter movies, the longest fight between him and Keith David.
Yeah.
And it becomes to a point where it's like Dadaism. Like, it keeps fucking going.
Yeah.
And it's to a ridiculous degree. Every time I watch it, I forget. This is longer than I remember the last time I watched it. You know what I mean? It's like
a Bellatar.
That's like a better example.
A fight sequence.
It's Workmeister harmonies. It's those scenes in that movie, but like with wrestling.
Yeah.
And the first time I watched that movie, I'm like, what am I watching?
Keith David in that fucking scene, man.
Well, they're so in. And that movie is like, that movie's a warm blanket for me, man. Like, I really love They Live. I could just hang out in that fucking movie.
I
love
it too, but I actually can't watch it that often. I don't watch it as often as the other ones, because even though as fun as I think the movie is, there's a paranoia
yes.
to it and a distrust in government that it actually makes me like, and especially the ending's so fucking bleak.
Yeah.
That like, it makes me not uncomfortable. That's the wrong word, but I'm unsettled by the end of it. Maybe more so than even some of Carpenter's horror movies, because I feel like that's the movie that, you know, not to keep bringing him up, but our buddy Shapiro maintains that that's the most subversive studio movie possibly ever made.
Which one?
They Live.
Oh, wow.
Because...
That's Universal, right?
Yeah, he essentially got Universal to pay for a movie starring a wrestler that essentially tells you that everything we consume is meant to control our minds and destroy our culture so that these greater unknown forces to us can take over the world. And it's like, that's pretty fucked up.
It's the invisible hand of economics or of capitalism. Right?
Exactly. You know? And to release that in basically the more or less the tail end of the Reagan era, the big boom of it, as you're transitioning into the George Bush senior years, like, there's an anger to They Live. And even that isn't really present in Prince of Darkness, but Prince of Darkness feels like almost like a stoner, like in the middle of like a depressed fugue state, to where it's like him just sitting there and being like, man, the world is bad. Well, I'm so high right now, but man, everything's so fucked up.
It lines up so well with one of my favorite Carpenter films too, which is Escape from New York. It's an angry, angry fucking movie.
Yeah.
Like, you forget that it's because like,
that movie rules.
It's just so fucking good, dude. Like, it, I mean, I don't think it's his best movie, but I just, you know, I've got the fucking Plissken woodcut on my wall behind me right now. I'm a huge fan of that character.
President of what?
But like, that movie is so, we people kind of joke about it now, but like, that's also a bleak, bleak look at the world. You know,
so is Escape from L.A.
That's even bleaker.
As janky as Jesus. It is, the ending of that movie is amazing. I mean, Carpenter's endings are like, they're the best, man.
The end shot of Prince of Darkness. putting his hand, it's like the opposite of a fucking Paul Schrader movie. Instead of putting the finger and touching the glass, you're like, yeah, she's over there, but she might be, if I don't fucking know if this glass is now a portal.
No.
And it just like.
Well, that's the other thing. I guess one of the closing thoughts we'll have before we get into questions is that Carpenter also works in all of the psychic transmission stuff, because I love those, that idea, to take it back to what we were saying with Quatermass in the Pit, is that idea of hive mind and how everybody was essentially linked psychically because of these tests that these aliens performed years ago. Well, in Prince of Darkness, once they all get into the same area, they all start sharing the same dream, which is essentially not a dream. It's a transmission from the year 1999, warning them essentially of what their actions are going to lead to, which may or may not be the end of the fucking world.
Yep. And we're really not 100% clear at the end if it worked. I'm pretty sure it didn't.
No.
It's kind of like live to fight another day. The evil's still there.
Yeah, we're all going to die eventually. It's like the, you know, Sarah Connor driving off at the end and being like, a storm's coming. Like,
yeah.
You won this battle, but in the end, the war's probably going to take us all.
Yeah.
You want to get to questions?
Oh, absolutely.
All right.
It's almost time, kids. The clock is ticking. Be in front of your TV sets for the horror-thon. And remember the big giveaway at 9. Don't miss it. And don't forget to wear your masks. The clock is ticking. It's almost time.
Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween, Super Shamrock. Happy, happy Halloween, Halloween, Halloween. Happy, happy Halloween.
And we're back with questions about 1987's Prince of Darkness. Now, Martin, I did a little bit of a curveball here. We're going to do a ranking, but it's not going to be a ranking of Hammer films.
Okay.
Nor is it going to be a ranking of John Carpenter movies. Nor is it going to be a ranking of Tobe Hooper movies. What it is going to be a ranking of is top three Carpenter endings.
Ooh!
Yeah. Because I feel like Prince of Darkness has a really fucking good one. Is it in the top three? I don't know. Because you got a lot of great ones in there to choose from.
Oh, man. Honestly, like, there aren't really any bad ones, you know? So it's like, it's hard to even cross anything off the list.
Well, The Ward. We can get rid of The Ward, I think.
Or like Memories of an Invisible Man, Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Which I don't strangely hate, but I'm also not going to be like, I'm ride or die for Memoirs of an Invisible Man.
Are we going to go 3-2-1? Is that what we're going
to
do?
Or? I don't give a shit. You can just give me, you don't even have to rank them.
Okay. Mouth of Madness.
Yeah, that's my number one.
I thought it was. It's top three for sure.
Just Sam Neill laughing at the end has stayed with me in a way that few finales ever have.
And just the meta-ness of it, of him watching the movie that we're watching, is so great in this like apocalyptic city. The one theater is playing the movie that we're watching. That, and then The Thing is just, I mean, I just think the look on their faces, we'll just sit here a while and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, that one's really fucking great.
That's just an all-time banger. You know what the other one is? It's the end of Halloween. I love The Breathing. I just think it's the greatest way. I did it for my first film in college on 16mm. I go, I'm going to cut these all these locations. My director, professor goes, what the fuck was that? I'm like, this was like Halloween. And he's like, don't do that again.
I like Halloween.
I was a fucking punk 19-year-old. I'm like, I got a 16mm camera.
You know what reminded me of Halloween lately? Is, have you watched those GoPro cat videos?
No.
Where they strap, there's a whole like TikTok channel, and I think, you know, also YouTube channel, where essentially they strap GoPros to street cats. And there's one in particular that's one of the most amazing pieces of filmmaking I've ever seen in my life. where it's just from the camera's almost harnessed like right under the cat's chin, and the video starts with the cat just wreaking havoc and picking a fight with another cat, going full on and like beating the shit out of another cat, and the other cat like runs away, and it proceeds to be a pursuit as the cat runs through. It's almost like a fleshy drone. It's just running cool. underneath cars, running through a park, like in pursuit of this cat. But to bring it back to the breathing, is by the end, the video goes on for so long that the cat, you can just hear, is running out of breath. It's like, it's like drooling by the end and whatever, but it will not give up the ghost. It's like, I'm gonna whoop this cat's ass. I'm so mad. It's the Michael Myers of fucking cats.
You should cut that sound over like just houses in our neighborhood. It'd be creepy.
And it's doing the weird like cat growl too, where it's like clearly getting pissed off that it can't catch the other cats. You're like, damn. You know what's the other great John Carpenter ending, though, not to transition too hard away from cat growls, is The Fog.
I was going to say. The Fog
is a really good one.
The death of.
Escape from New York and Escape from L.A. Escape from L.A., probably a better ending, even though obviously not a better movie, but maybe a better ending than Escape from New York.
Welcome to the human race. Well, I mean, the end of New York of him, that just the image of him pulling out the tape and walking out of frame as the it goes to a dissolve to black.
Yeah.
It's not a cut. God, we've watched them too many times. Yeah. They're like, but The Fog was another one that was, I was tempted.
The final moments with Hal Holbrook.
Is just, why not me? Why not me, Blake?
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, good stuff,
that's
man.
That's good shit, dude.
So double feature with Prince of Darkness, even though I feel like we kind of already did this by doing, I mean, Prince of Darkness and Life Force.
I would say we do double feature with anything from.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. I was going to add another, I would do another kind of Quatermass inspired film is Sputnik. And that's a really cool. Russian horror sci-fi film, very similar setup of a guy comes back from space. He's behind glass. It's a full on like science, installation, secret installation of trying to discover what happened to this guy. And it's a really cool, as you slowly to kind of realize what is happening. Also has just it's my favorite designs of a movie in the last like 15 years. It's like that 1980s, like military Russian base, orange carpets, but like all their outfits are just looked at like a Metal Gear Solid fucking character. I don't know. Like I ate that movie up, but a similar setup to The Creeping Unknown or, you know, Quatermass Experiment.
I would go with Quatermass in the Pit and a movie that we've already covered on this podcast a little while back, Leviathan.
Oh man.
Which I think would be a hell of a fun double feature. Both have pretty similar structures and just end in absolutely like phenomenal apocalyptic fashion.
And it just rules.
And it's also just like great good. Casts. Yeah. And Peter Weller doing his Peter Weller thing. I mean, if you want to hear more about Leviathan, just go back and listen to our full Leviathan episode. But that would be my answer. I would do those two together.
I had one more just pop in my head. Is Altered States would go well, I think, with any of these, because also about the science and science meets like mythology and mysticism of like also like the idea of what's buried deep in our DNA. And like the idea, especially with like Quatermass in the Pit, of like, what if we're connected to this like alien race that have, and with Altered States, you have the deeper he goes, he's like connecting to this like
the primordial
ooze.
So remake. And I think we'll just stick with Quatermass with this.
They did a later one with, I forget his fucking name, Jason from Lockstock, the fourth guy.
Fleming,
yeah. And I guess it wasn't very good, like a miniseries. I think I'd like to see a modern day one. I'd like to see it as like a miniseries too, like a BBC, like Stephen Moffat style, like what
he was gonna say the same thing, almost like a Doctor Who style, yep, like exactly. series,
yep,
where it's just Quatermass and it's him investigating. kind of like what we were talking about with you, you were saying with like the X-Files and stuff, is that he becomes almost like your Fox Mulder.
Yep.
But he's a rocket scientist and he's just getting into various investigations and hijinks and whatnot, and you know, continually repelling the invasion of Earth by an unknown alien force.
I mean, honestly, too, on top of that, maybe not even make it modern day and make it like 60s or 50s and let them luxuriate in like the mod. Because you know what? You know they would have so much fun with that. Like if Stephen Moffat wrote that, or like Russell Davies, you know, like worked with like the fun of like the swinging 60s. And
yeah, that could be fun. But I could also see like a modern Quatermass being awesome, because you could create, like, imagine Quatermass, you know, the scientist who's essentially doing all of his experiments to further the good of humanity, to push them to the next level, and like having like his Blofeld be like Elon Musk, to where he's just a massive, like the idea of like pure science versus like almost like, for lack of a better term, like jerk off science.
Yeah.
To where it's just like this dude. Did you see the fucking, I guess Elon Musk had a big thing over at SpaceX the other day where they had robots come out and they were like robot bartenders and they were making people drinks. And of course these fucking nerds, who these tech bro douchebag motherfuckers,
are please like, leave our town. Please go away.
Are just like, you know, I think, like, I saw one tweet from one of these guys and I was like, I will choke you to death. where he was like, you know what? This guy, this robot made a better mojito than any bartender in town, and he didn't flip a screen over to ask me to tip 20%. And I'm like,
yeah, I hate you for so many reasons.
I hope that robot fists you to death. I hope he malfunctions. Because have you seen a motherfucker like Elon Musk? Like, is there anybody else on this planet who's like, you know what? Maybe Skynet had some good ideas.
He's the one. He's the one.
He is Skynet. He's the guy who's going to let the robots kill us all.
He's worm tongue, man. That photo of him shaking Donald Trump's hand at that rally, I'm just like, God. But okay, on to happier things like Quatermass. Question off of this, who would be a great modern Quatermass? Now, do we go old? Because I was thinking Jared Harris.
Oh, man.
How cool would that be?
That might be unbeatable.
I think it's just the
one. You might have just had it. Trying to think what other great stately British actors that we have left.
But I'm thinking like in their like 60s, you know, like late 50s, 60s. I think professorial is what we want to go for.
I mean,
oh, Bill Nighy.
Bill Nighy would be great. Oh, my God. That's another good one. I mean, I've been watching a lot of Slow Horses lately.
Oh, don't get me started.
If you cleaned Gary Oldman up and brought him in,
he'd murder it.
He might not be the worst choice. Also, what's his face from Brazil?
Oh, my God. Jonathan.
Jonathan Pryce.
Jonathan Pryce.
Like, he's almost, you haven't started watching the show yet.
No, right? I want to.
This show is so uniquely your fucking shit, because it's just like, it's the idea of like, okay, like almost like Tinker Tailor and George Smiley and all those guys, they were real. And this is the next iteration of that, is that it's this hybrid of like true MI5.
Yeah.
Kind of like spycraft.
Real spycraft.
And real spycraft with like kind of like Bourne exercises and stuff. And like Gary Oldman just doing this station chief thing of just this rumpled, farting, fat, bloated piece of shit who also knows better than everybody and commands this whole station of losers essentially to investigate all of these acts of treason. And like, you know, the second season is all about sleeper agents called cicadas who are awakened.
What?
And they have to like hunt down and like,
what are you talking about?
Yeah, this is like, this is your thing. But Jonathan Pryce plays one of the agents' fathers who's now retired and kind of lives on this old estate and is his link back to the old days and will tell things about the old days. But he's essentially just playing like George Smiley if George Smiley was retired.
Oh, man.
It's awesome. Like, you need... And the other thing, dude, like, not to sell this and turn this into a Slow Horses podcast and really hard sell you on it, but the seasons are old school BBC, like, length. They're all 6 episodes long. So you can just rifle through, like, one... And they're all self-contained stories that... set up like relationships right. and arcs and everything for everything, but they're all, each story has a beginning, a middle, and end because they're all adaptations of, I believe the author's name is Mick Herron, who just has written a series of these spy books that are like basically like airport novels essentially that they've made into these very polished, well-produced miniseries that are essentially that are also executive produced by Graham Yost.
Dude, I'm so on.
Yeah, I mean, I think you'd love it.
Well, it's, I heard
that. And also, Kristen Scott Thomas plays Gary Oldman's rival. Like, she's the one who they call Mother, who basically heads up the true MI5, where, like, he is like, the one who basically is babysitting, like, their cast-offs, the ones Ooh. Who are, like, their fuck-ups. Like, it's pretty fucking cool.
I'm doing it. I'm doing it, man. I all you had to say was Tinker Tailor, dude. I read that book and then watched the miniseries of Alec Guinness.
Yeah.
And then I like the movie too, but like the you need that length. You need the time with Smiley.
I really like the Thomas Alfredson one too.
No, I do, but I just think like I like the miniseries more because you need that. I like the slowness and the like the staid British, you know, you
it's that not, stiff it's, upper lip, even just, in the storytelling.
Yeah, and Le Carré is just like just one of the best authors I've ever read in my entire life. He's just, he's next level.
So, Face Melter for Prince of Darkness. Yay, nay.
No.
I'd go with no, too, because again, it's more of just like both of our relationships to the movie going back and forth. Like, it didn't blow us away. It still hasn't, but like, it's almost like crept up on me.
Yeah.
In the way that now I'm kind of like, is this one of his best? Is this top 5 Carpenter? I'm not sure.
I'm just glad it's there. I mean, we've watched so many of the big boys over and over again. I mean, I've seen Halloween more than any other movie.
Would it rank if we were to actually do this? Because, like, number one is probably still Halloween, right?
Yep.
If we're going to, like, boil it down to brass tacks, it's Halloween or The Thing.
Yep. Those are interchangeable, one and two.
For me, In the Mouth of Madness is very high up. That's, I know, a lot of people have like Shapiro doesn't like that movie. And he has a weird relationship to it where I watch it once a year.
Yeah.
Escape from New York.
The Fog's up there.
See, the...
I know you're not as big a fan.
So if we were going to do a top 5 and we had Halloween, Escape from New York,
The Thing,
Mouth of Madness... That 5 spot would be like a knife fight.
Yeah.
Between Prince of Darkness, maybe The Fog.
I like Precinct 13 a lot too, honestly. Shit.
They live might just be number 5. They might be knife fighting for number 6, honestly.
Yeah.
Because it's like you would be looking at The Fog, Prince of Darkness, Escape from Assault on Precinct 13.
Yep.
And after that, I mean, then you're into bottom tier.
Oh, Carpenter. And Christine.
Oh, shit.
What are we doing here?
No, Christine's top 5.
Yeah.
What are we saying?
That's top 5.
No. Yeah. That bumps even They Live out.
Like, it's so fucking. I was like, what are we? I was like, we're forgetting.
Let's talk about stealth masterpieces. It's a masterpiece that we even forgot fucking existed. And it was like, wait, we're forgetting something. What a great fucking movie Christine is.
Oh, my God.
Well, Martin, this has been great.
Oh, dude, this was a really fun one.
And we got to fire off not only some Carpenter, but some Toby Hooper and a bunch of British horror. What do we have next for these fine listeners out there in Secret Handshake Land?
Well, we're very excited to be going to another edition of Exhumed.
Yes.
We leave in 4 days. But when we're back, we're going Down Under for some Ozploitation horror. And we haven't solidified the list yet, but it is
it's a long list.
There's like 30 movies on there right now. We're gonna have to definitely
whittle that one down.
But they're all gonna be fucking bangers.
Probably be referencing Mark Hartley's Not quite Hollywood.
Oh, yeah.
Once again. So, but you'll have to stay tuned next time to Secret Handshake to find out more.
See you then.
Also to see if Martin kills a prostitute.